PeterGreenberg.com. You can actually even track where she's going. Back with more from Sydney.
Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from Sydney in Australia, broadcasting from the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know exactly what to do. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. In fact, let's do that right now. Here's one from Angie in Savannah, Georgia. She writes, I put a down payment on my trip coming up this December to Hong Kong. I have a pre-existing medical condition that shouldn't cause me to cancel my trip. However, I have a medically fragile grandson and would not travel if he became ill at the last minute. Two insurance companies I've talked with say his condition is considered a pre-existing condition, so I would not be covered. I traveled in 2014 and don't remember this being a problem. Is this a recent change with the travel medical insurance world? Actually, it's not. They have essentially expanded their definition of pre-existing conditions. And remember, what you're insuring yourself for when you travel. Are you insuring yourself for just a medical issue? Are you insuring yourself for weather? Are you insuring yourself for a catastrophic job situation? Every policy has different language. And you need to decipher that language to make sure that you're actually buying a policy that basically helps you if you need it. Otherwise, it's worthless. So there's one website I suggest. It's called InsureMyTrip.com. They've done the Herculean task of deciphering policy language, which no mortal can do, between insurance policies so that you actually know what's covered and what isn't and what it's going to cost. So go to that website first with the different companies that you're exploring it with to determine which one will allow this to happen should it happen. Other than that, you're really rolling the dice. So there you have it. You mentioned something else, though, that I found interesting in your email. You said you put a down payment on your trip coming up this December. Well, that's more than 6 months away. And remember, whenever you're asked to put up a down payment or pay for a substantial portion of the trip, or in some cases pay for the entire trip more than 6 months in advance, if you pay by a check, you're doing a stupid thing. If you're paying by credit card, you're also doing a stupid thing because under the federal credit law, you're only allowed to recoup your losses if you did not receive the goods or services that you contracted for within 60 days of the date you actually used the credit card. So any travel operator that's asking you for a substantial amount of money or a down payment more than 60 days out, well, your money's at risk. Unless they can prove to you that they're putting your money into a bonded escrow account that they can't touch unless and until your trip is actually completed. So that's another thing to consider over and above the issue of travel insurance. Here's one from Georgia Thompson in Mesa, Arizona. I'll be traveling to a foreign country next year during the winter time. I've heard from friends to bring only some cash and an ATM debit card. They say it's safer and maybe pickpocketers won't be able to steal my cash, but wouldn't they still have an equal chance of pickpocketing my cash along with my debit card? Okay, here's the deal. Nobody needs a lot of cash in their pocket. Nobody needs a lot of traveler's checks in their pocket because all a traveler's check is an interest-free loan you're giving the traveler's check issuer. That's why they give you that handy wallet so that when you come back, you put the unused checks in your dresser drawer and they're making money on the float because you haven't used the money that is actually yours. So my advice is this. You only need enough cash that your debit card's going to give you in local currency when you get there. If you want to bring along 4 or 5 extra traveler's checks for emergencies, great. And they also bring a credit card as well. And whatever you do, don't carry the credit card and the ATM card in the same pocket or even in the same suitcase if you're going to pack one. Separate them out so that you're never at a loss of both cards. And then everything's going to be fine. The reason why I like the ATM card is you're not changing money. You're not getting hit with commissions or a bad exchange rate. What you're doing is you're only taking out with your ATM card the local currency and the amount that you actually need it in any one day. And if you do your homework, you can check with your own banking institution that issues the card or one that issues another ATM card to find out which institution doesn't charge you to use foreign ATMs or which one doesn't charge you an outrageous exchange rate fee. There are many companies now that give you no foreign transaction fee, no use of the ATM fee, and therefore, or they'll rebate it, and therefore you're home free. You're not going to come back with sticker shock of, you know, $200 or $300 every time, you know, for all the times you use the ATM machine. Okay? Or I should say the ATM. Saying the ATM machine is redundant. I've learned that, as you just heard on the air. So that's my advice. Bottom line is you use only the money you need. You're getting the same exchange rate that the banks are giving their best customers on the day that you're doing it. And you're not spending a lot of money in commissions to change money back and forth through the money changers, right? And whatever you do not change any U.S. currency for foreign currency in the United States before you leave. That is the worst efficient way you could do it. Bottom line is, wait till you get there. Use the ATM machine anywhere you can, especially if you have the rule from your bank that says you're not going to get hit with a fee. And then you're home free both coming in and then going out. Pack the card separately and you'll be ready. And as far as pickpocketing, if you have a minimal amount of cash in your pocket, you're good. Got it? Okay. That music means we're out of time for this hour, but stick around. We've got a whole lot more coming from Sydney, Australia, as Peter Greenberg Worldwide returns from the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Back with more right after this.
Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Around the world, the trip begins with a guest. Roam if you want to, roam around the world. And now the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome back aboard Peter Greenberg Worldwide. If you're just joining us, get out your maps, boys and girls. Let me tell you where we are. 33 degrees, 51 minutes south, 151 degrees, 12 minutes east. And we are south. We're in Sydney, Australia, coming to you from the studios of the Australia Broadcasting Corporation, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know exactly what to do. You email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it throughout the air. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Peter S. Greenberg, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Peter Greenberg. You know, I have had a love affair, and I've been wanting to talk to this author for a while, with Paris and with France, since my parents took me there at the age of 12. And so I went there literally as a boy. So, of course, I was drawn to this book title called Finding Fontainebleau, An American Boy in France. And the author is Thad Carhart. Hey, Thad, how are you?
Hey, Peter. I'm good.
So let me see if I get this straight. 26 years ago, you moved to Paris with your wife and two infant children, but this story goes back way before then, doesn't it?
That's right. It goes to my early childhood when I was the son of an Air Force officer, and he was assigned from Washington to Fontainebleau, which is where the NATO headquarters was at that time. And we lived in that town, and I went to French schools and lived there for 3 years. So that's where my love affair with France started.
Sure. Now, you heard me say in the introduction, Fontainebleau. You said Fontainebleau.
Well, it's a tricky word, even in French. It's actually Fontainebleau because it's fountain of the beautiful waters. But you got it pretty close. It's if you think of it's not what is often pronounced for the hotel in Miami, Fontainebleau. It's Fontainebleau.
Right.
It's not a blue fountain. It's a lovely fountain. But that's an academic point.
No, but I'm glad you corrected me. Hey, listen, this is really not a book about you going back in the 80s. It's really a book about your childhood there.
That's right. The crux of the book really is what the subtitle says, An American Boy in France. And it was France in the 50s, which was, of course, I'm sure you know, a very different place from the France we know today, which is very much more modern and changed in lots of respects. But in other respects, the Fontainebleau Chateau and other pieces are still as eternal as they always have been.
I mean, to me, France in the 50s, if I've done my homework, and I was in France in the 60s, but France in the 50s to me was Algiers and the French Foreign Legion and Charles de Gaulle. And part of that was your experience as well, right?
It was, but to be honest, I was we lived there when I was 4 to the age of 7. So I started school in France. It was maternelle, which is the equivalent of kindergarten or preschool. And then I went through the equivalent of grades 1 and 2, but always in the French system. So from a child's point of view, especially since my dad was at the NATO headquarters, I sort of took that in a little bit above my head and had really the experience of an American boy, but living on the French system. That's what I try to focus on in the book. Not that the as an adult, of course, the politics of that time interest me a great deal, but I was not involved in it at that level.
Sure. Now let's talk about the politics of this time. So many of my listeners are afraid of going to France now after the incidents last November in Paris. And I'm one of those people who believes that the best time to go somewhere, as politically incorrect as it sounds, is after a natural disaster or an act of civil disturbance or an act of political terrorism. And I sent a number of my friends kicking and screaming to Paris in early December, basically 10 to 12 days after the incidents that happened in the nightclub, and they were scared out of their minds. And guess what? Within 24 hours of them being there, they asked to extend their trip.
Well, you're a lot more qualified than I am to comment on what is a good or not a good time. But I happen to agree with you that both in terms of the practical side of the security apparatus, it is redoubtable in France. The French really are good at what they do, and they take it variously. So from last November's attacks and then, of course, the Charlie Hebdo attacks last January, it's been a shock, and there's no two ways about it. But I would not call it a dangerous in any respect, as long as you exercise ordinary prudence, which you would anywhere. I wouldn't call it a dangerous place at all, no.
And, of course, since you've been there, like most Americans, you're now conflicted because every one of your friends decides to come and visit you.
Actually, I wish more people would come visit, but they do. My children went through the French system over there and then decided to go to university in America. So they've stayed in New York, and I have to come here, and my wife spends a lot of her time in New York to see them. But it's not hard to get people to come over and visit. It's true. When you extend that invitation, it generally gets picked up.
Well, we're talking 26 years later from the time you moved back there. What's changed for the better in Paris for you, and what hasn't?
What's changed for the better is that, and you know this, I'm sure, the apparatus, the whole infrastructure is remarkably modern, so that I and my wife both like not having to drive a car. We own a car, but we hardly ever use it. Occasionally we use it to go out of town, but the public transportation and the trains, and the very fast trains, inner-city trains, are just a luxury that is rare elsewhere in the world, we find. The other thing I'd say is the school system, it served our children well, and it served me well, and that really hasn't changed. What I think is a little bit disturbing is there is still a hidebound bureaucracy in France, and that doesn't seem able to respond as quickly as it might to the challenges of a modern era. And I think the French will get that together. But right now they're pondering. And French pondering is a long process, but then when they make a decision, they tend to go with it. So I'm favorably impressed that will come before we know it.
We're talking with Thad Carbert, the author of Finding Fontainebleau, An American Boy in France. And so can you basically conjugate the verb to ponder in French?
Well, it's the same word, actually. Pondérer, je pondère, tu pondères, il pondère, nous pondérons, vous pondérez, il pondère. Present tense.
All right, you get an A in my class, which I failed miserably in high school.
Well, you get an A for enthusiasm and interest, and actually knowing the interest that people bring to France, which is quite extraordinary. So I hope you'll visit Fontainebleau, and some of your listeners will, too. It's quite an extraordinary place.
It is. And, of course, my biggest lament is all the bridges above Paris right now where they removed all the padlocks from those lovers who put them on there.
Oh, well, Peter, you and I might have to agree to disagree about that because they became, well, you know what the issue was. They became opaque with locks, so you couldn't even see the water. But apart from that, they were dangerous. They started to fall off, some of the panels. And then they thought, well, if they pull on a boat, you know, they're all the tourist boats go under the bridges.
I got it.
What are we going to do? It wasn't just the lawyers saying, you know, this is dangerous and you got to do this. It was a real problem. But they haven't taken them all down, actually. There are still a few bridges that are to be worked on. So.
Thad Carhart, the author of Finding Fontainebleau, An American Boy in France. Great read. And you should read it before you go back to Paris, which, of course, you should. Hey, speaking of that, we'll be back to Sydney as Peter Greenberg Worldwide returns to the studios of the ABC right after this.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. And as I do every week at this time, I encourage you to go to our website, petergreenberg.com, for our comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that hard and essential work all around the world. An opportunity for you to get up close and personal, to immerse yourself and give back every time you travel. Really worthwhile organizations. And we always like to localize the volunteerism opportunities wherever we do our show. And of course, Australia is no exception, especially in Sydney. Check out a group called Harbour Care. These guys really help keep the beaches of North Sydney clean. Volunteers are needed on a daily basis to pick up the garbage and also clean the beaches. And when you do that, and by the way, if you're between the ages of 18 and 90, they'll take you. But when you do that, you hang out with the locals, the people who actually live here, the people who actually know their neighborhoods better than anybody else, beyond any guidebook or brochure. What a great opportunity to be outside, be on the beach, help the community, and then become part of it and learn things you never learned before because you're not just at your hotel. If you want more information on Harbour Care, just go right to our website, petergreenberg.com, for that comprehensive list for anything you can do every time you travel just about anywhere in the world. And speaking of just about anywhere in the world, that's where you'll find our next guest, one of the world's great explorers, one of the world's great travelers. I'm proud to call him a friend. We've traveled together many times. He's just back from two very different locations, Cape Town and, get ready for this one, Saudi Arabia. His name, Richard Bangs. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Peter. Always good to talk.
So let's talk about the fun one, and then about the interesting one, which may have also I know, but let's talk about the one that essentially at least means fun, Cape Town.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you were just there recently, right? I think I was.
We actually broadcast from there during the Virtuoso meeting. I've been going to Cape Town for over 30 years since before Mandela was released, so I've seen a lot of the change, and you continue to see the change.
It's probably one of the most stunning landscapes on the planet. There's no place that has that light and that sort of magic to it, and it's also iconic because it's the passageway to the Cape of Good Hope, one of those brands that you always grew up as a traveler going, I got to go see that. I got to touch that.
So, you know, Richard, you talk about the light, and I want to focus on that for a second because I think too many people forget about it. I judge a place when I want to go back to it, when it's had an impact on me, based on a number of different things that most people don't do. I judge based on where I sleep the best, and I also judge it based on proximity to water, and I also judge it based on light. Cape Town has all three.
It does. It does. You know, it's funny. They've become somewhat of a Hollywood South or a Hollywood Africa, and they've done lots of films there. Eye in the Sky was just shot there with Helen Mirren, and they did a season of Homeland there. And they stood in Cape Town for Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I could not swallow the episodes. I couldn't believe them because the light was so different. I've been to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Yeah, the you're right. The Cape Town light is just so iridescent and magical. It's like some sort of wonderland. And with Table Mountain right there, sort of painted all the time with the light, it's just it's always stunning.
And by the way, you know, we're broadcasting from Sydney today. Much of Australia has that same kind of light.
It does. It's the latitude, you know. So it is. I think.
And by the way, in both cases, you get to experience it in three different ways that I think are special. Obviously on the water, by train, or in the air. When I'm down in Cape Town, I go flying with a good friend of mine named Andy Kluver, and we go zipping down by jet to the Cape and back in 8 minutes, and then we're hugging the whole Western Cape on the coast.
Wow.
It's just phenomenal light over Table Mountain. Wow. You do the same thing here in Sydney with seaplanes over Rose Bay and all the way up to Hawkesbury. It's just amazing. And of course, politically, you're dealing with a country that's still going through change in South Africa. You're dealing with a country that still has great trouble with its leader, who's obviously in a little bit of trouble right now.
Right, but only a year and a half left in his reign. So,
Exactly. And then the best part about it from a traveler's perspective, if you happen to be from the U.S., and you were just there, Richard, so you know, the U.S. dollar at historic strength levels against the South African rand, where
it's
I talked about this earlier in the show.
It's the most value-added place in the world right now. You could sit down and have these fabulous three-star Michelin meals for under $50. And a great bottle of wine
my
is
metric,
$3 or $4. Yeah.
You're going to laugh at me, but my metric was hotel laundry. because it's usually the most overpriced item on the menu at a
That's
hotel.
That's better than the Big Mac index from The Economist.
we've used that many times. which, by the way, South Africa does very well in the Big Mac index. But, if you take a look at the hotel laundry indicator, I had 5 shirts with me that needed to be pressed and laundered. and I'm terrified of hotel laundries because the charge at a hotel laundry is usually more than the shirt itself. I said, you know what? I'm going to put my rand to the dollar principle to the test. I sent 5 shirts out. I asked for, starch and folded and boxes. I mean, I put every bell and whistle on the instructions. They came back at 6 o'clock that night, beautifully done, $11.
What hotel? That makes a difference.
The Mount Nelson.
Oh, nice. I was at the 12 Apostles, which is a...
Oh, the 12... Listen, the 12 Apostles, now that we're talking, run by my good friend and owned by my good friend Brett Tolman, the 12 Apostles, they have a restaurant that you need to go there on Saturday or Sunday around 11:30 in the morning and sit outside.
Oh, boy, isn't that beautiful? Yeah. Talk about water and light. That's it. So
you can't beat that. Hey, listen, but let's shift gears and talk about something truly remarkable. You just set a record of sorts as the first American adventure travel trip inside Saudi Arabia.
Yes, and that was a long time coming. I've spent 16 years and probably 1,000 cups of tea trying to negotiate our way into the kingdom. And we finally got it. So we crossed the empty quarter. Of course, another one of the iconic names in travel lore. And with the Bedouins and the camels, and then we went up to Madain Saleh, which is very close to some of the areas that you explored when you did the whole royal tour with the King of Jordan. It's right on the border, and it's the same Nabataean sort of kingdom extended into Saudi Arabia, which is part of that spice route. And that was incredible. The tombs there were amazing. They're like Petra, but without tourists.
Exactly. And the other thing is, a year ago I was in Abu Dhabi and went out about 40 miles on camel, and I was literally 2 miles from the Saudi border and the empty quarter. And I was the only, it was me, my camel driver, and me, and my camel.
Yeah, I know.
And that was it.
It's empty. It truly is empty. But it's beautiful. It's a stunning, stunning landscape, and it's the largest sand desert in the world with nobody in it.
And yet, there are still no tourist visas being given because they don't exist yet, do they?
They do not exist. They've never existed since the kingdom came into being. They've always felt that they didn't need tourism. It sort of corrupted their sanctity.
But they're starting to change.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, it's the economics of oil are changing rapidly, and they're reevaluating many things. They're gonna float Aramco as an IPO, something that would have been unthinkable just a couple of years ago. They need monies, according to the IMF. At their current rate of spend and oil at its current prices, they'll be bankrupt by 2020. So they are reconsidering, and hopefully tourism will be something that they do.
Well, they actually have a minister of tourism now. He's Prince Salman, who is the son of the current king and the former Saudi astronaut. He was the Saudi astronaut who went up to the space station. And he and I have had 4 or 5 meetings together about doing a royal tour in Saudi Arabia.
Well, wouldn't that be great?
Wow. Now, they haven't said yes, but here's the good news. They haven't said no.
That's the Saudi way. So
I know. I know.
I'll tell you a good little story. I was in Riyadh, and we were in the ancient part of the city. And, of course, as tourists, we had lots of veiled women who came up to us and took our photos. And one veiled woman took a shot and then walked over to me and asked in perfect English, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from the United States." She goes, "Well, what state?" I said, "California." And she goes, "Well, where in California?" "Los Angeles." "Where in Los Angeles?" "Venice." And I go, "Boy, your English is amazing." And how do you do that? And she goes, well, I watch a lot of American movies on my computer at home. And I go, well, what's your favorite American movie? And she goes, The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, no. We're in trouble now. Richard Bangs. Of course, you can follow him on his own website, richardbangs.com. Back right after this.
Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you, coming to you from Sydney, Australia, taking the calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know exactly what to do. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. I remember when I first came to Sydney, that was back in 1975. And then I came back many times since, but in 1981 was stuck at a place called King's Cross, back at a time where it was not such a great neighborhood, although it's certainly turned around now. And then as you learn more and more about Sydney, you find out about all the other neighborhoods that people really, who are visitors, don't know about until they literally get out of their comfort zone and go see them. And one of the newest, if you really want to talk about it, in terms of development, is Chippendale. And joining me now, the creative director of the Chippendale Creative Precinct. I like that name. Nikki Ginsberg, how are you?
Hello, nice to see you.
Yeah,
you.
So, I mean, the whole idea of the Creative Precinct goes back only 6 years.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I arrived in Chippendale in 2007.
From
and I
London?
Set up,
from
no,
what?
No, no. I arrived in London in 1986. Right. So I've been here a long time.
Well, you went to the university here too.
Correct.
Right.
But I bought a building in Chippendale in 2007 to set up the NG Art Gallery and Mission Restaurant Bar when Chippendale really was relatively unknown. It was very European in style, quite bohemian.
Nothing wrong with bohemian.
No, it's lovely. I think that's what really gives it its character.
Yeah.
And it was stuck between three universities, and I never really understood why it hadn't taken off as a destination. There was nothing there. It was a cultural desert. So I set about turning it into something extremely exciting and buzzing and culturally alive.
And how many galleries are
we
there now?
We now have 22 galleries in Chippendale. So we've done very well.
Are you doing gallery walks?
We are doing gallery walks. We have on the first Saturday of every month the Explore Chippendale free gallery walking tour.
Is wine included?
Wine is included.
I knew it.
And we offer lunch in Spice Alley, which is one of our newest alleyways adjacent to Kensington Street, which is a fantastic destination.
You know, what's interesting to me, and it's not just particular to Sydney, but and that is you take a look at the revitalization and the rebirth of so many neighborhoods in the United States. It really was driven by the art scene. It was driven by the galleries. And then when they did the gallery walks and people actually got out and saw stuff, then they came back.
Absolutely. I think the thing is to try. I think culture is really important to any city, and we've really got to make a point of establishing that. So I set about doing that. And then, as you say, what comes next is the food, the alcohol, the bars, the pubs, the fine dining. So I think Kensington Street currently right now is really buzzing. I think we have about 16 different sort of eateries and bars
well,
in Kensington
Well, you know where
Street.
I was yesterday.
Where?
Kensington Social.
Oh, okay. Isn't that lovely?
Unbelievable.
Fantastic.
Right next to the Old Claire.
Yes, right. And that's beautiful. Just been refurbished.
They've done a
hotel.
Great job there.
65-bedroom hotel, 5-star, swimming pool at the top, cocktails.
But here's what I liked about that street.
Yeah.
You can walk it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is not, you don't have to take a mass transportation, you don't have to get in a car, you just walk.
Yes, no, it's fabulous. And did you find Spice Alley around the side of it?
Did you manage? That's where the galleries.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they're the galleries that I run currently, the two little galleries.
Well,
there,
that's very scary because I could have done a lot of damage in those galleries, let me tell you.
Well, they were all sold, so too bad.
I know.
But you missed out.
But the good news is, I mean, you've kept those buildings too.
Yeah. Well, it was the vision of Dr. Stanley Quek, who's the former chairman of Fraser's Property Australia, who redeveloped the old brewery site, Central Park, which you probably saw as you walked through.
Absolutely.
Which is a fantastic just renovation and visionary sort of change to the neighborhood. And then he purchased the street from Fraser's Property Australia, so set about 7 years ago to establish a Kensington Street, really taking into consideration the character, the heritage, and sort of restoring it with the love and passion that it really deserves. And then I now work with him as well as his creative director. So I have many hats, the president of the Chippendale Creative Precinct, then his creative director for Kensington Street. So it has a lovely synergy because I can do everything that I want for Chippendale, and it's incredibly exciting.
And the thing that's interesting and people should know about it is if you're in downtown Sydney, if you're down by the rocks, let's say, the distance between that and Chippendale is what? Nothing.
Not really. It's probably about 20 minutes in a car.
Which is pretty quick. Yeah.
And the other thing I just want to mention, because I'm so excited about it, is we've just about to establish the historical walking tours of Sydney. Of Chippendale.
And will wine be involved?
And wine. And food and Spice Alley. And we're launching on the second Saturday of every month. And we're launching that in July. And then in September, we're launching the Food Safari program, which will take you all around Chippendale, as will the historical walking tour and the gallery walking tour. So we're doing a lot to really sort of activate the area, to bring life to it, to bring people to it, audiences to it, to showcase, you know, all that we have, which is really rich and exciting.
Well, you know, and it's not contrived, which is what I like about it. I mean, if you want to be able to walk it, it's not because somebody's forcing you to walk. It lends itself to walking.
Absolutely. And there's lots of nooks and crannies to discover. It's not just focused around Kensington Street. You can move around the neighborhood. And I think it reminds me a little bit of Chelsea of New York, which is sort of 5 years ago.
You know, it does.
I got that idea from, let's try and make the Chelsea of New York in Chippendale. And I think the idea behind is when you arrive in Chelsea, you sort of think everything's going to be on one street, but it's not.
You actually
have to walk around, discover it. And I think that's the beauty of it. And it gets you exercising as well, which is also very important.
To work off all the wine you'll be drinking.
And food, amazing food you'll be eating too.
Nikki Ginsberg, the creative director of Chippendale Creative Precinct. Good luck on that, because I'm telling you, it works.
Thank you.
And we had a great time yesterday at the Kensington Social, which was a surprising discovery, because until I walked in, I didn't know it existed. Yeah. Now I do. Nikki, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide when we return to Sydney right after this.
Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you in Sydney in Australia from the studios of the ABC, or the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know exactly what to do. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com. with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. It's so amazing to me how much we don't know about Australia and how much we don't know about a culture of a country that as a country may only go back 200 years, but as a culture goes back way further than that. And this is especially true of Sydney, because when you think of the Aboriginal culture, people who visit Sydney think, oh, I have to go out into the outback for that. I have to go way west. The answer is no. They were here too. And in fact, they were here in abundance. And joining me now, somebody who knows a lot about that, Mary Mumbula, who's with the Barangaroo Delivery Authority.
Yes.
Whatever that means.
That's a
Barangaroo.
Barangaroo, yes. Yeah. It's named after an Aboriginal woman who actually came from the Gammeraygal clan across the harbour to the north.
Right, but when you say across the harbour to the north, we're talking less than 20 miles.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And how much... you know, there's a period that you see in South Africa after Mandela, where you had a period of reconciliation and forgiveness. You're still very much a part of that right now in Australia. If you look at the history of the treatment of the Aboriginal people by the British and then by the Australians itself, there was some pretty horrendous stuff.
Yes, there was.
And so you're still in that process of reconciliation and bringing that history back to life, so that people know the origins and they know the history and they know the reason why they're even standing where they're standing now.
Yep.
So for someone visiting Sydney for the first time, what are the Aboriginal secrets here that they can discover?
Well, they can come on down to Barangaroo. Barangaroo is a brand new reserve that's been open since September, and we do some Aboriginal cultural tours on the reserve.
And we're also talking immersive experiences too.
Yes.
See, that's the thing. I hate to say this. I'm embarrassed as an American because we have the same issue with the American Indian. And when you go to certain locations in the Southwest, the Indians are sort of like showpieces. They're performing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is such an insult.
Yeah.
You don't do that.
No, we don't do that at all. We give you a bit of a history on the harbour of the Gadigal and the Gammeraygal and Wangal people that lived on the harbour of Sydney. And we'll tell you about a bit of, you know, the bush tucker that they ate and, you know, the marine life.
Yeah, let's talk about what they ate. Because a couple of years ago, I was out there in the bush, way out west, right? And they said, okay, guess what? Your turn, Greenberg. You're going to eat some Aboriginal grub.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're laughing. I wasn't laughing.
Oh, that was... well, it's nice. Was it a witchetty grub?
Yes, it was. Now, you know what? I remember it very well, right? Tell them what a witchetty grub is. Come on.
A witchetty grub is
a caterpillar.
It's like a caterpillar.
It's a caterpillar.
Yeah, a big fat one.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a big Now you're really laughing at me. And it was a little squirmy and a little, right?
Yep, very
squirmy. And you can tell me anything you want, like it tastes just like chicken. I don't care. But I got through it.
Yeah.
But I also appreciated it at that point. Because one of the things that you learn very quickly in researching the Aboriginal culture is what they had to make do with, what they discovered from basically back directly to nature, right? What you could do with the bark of a tree.
Yep.
What you could do medically from a bark of a tree.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. They also indicate whether, you know, like the wattle, the Sydney golden wattle here in Sydney, also it indicates that the whales are moving north when it's in bloom. So, you know, there's all different indications that could come from our bush foods.
And there's still so many things that we can learn from Aboriginal history, which is still being practiced today.
That's right.
Mary Mumbula from the Barangaroo Delivery Authority with all sorts of secrets that... What's the biggest surprise? The biggest surprise that your visitor gets when they first visit you?
I think the story of Barangaroo and that she actually was the second wife of Bennelong, who was a warrior. And if you know where the Opera House sits, it actually sits on Bennelong Point. So it's only fitting we have Bennelong on one side of the harbour bridge and now we have Barangaroo Reserve. So a lot of people don't know that she was his wife, really.
Right.
So, and then... just to hear about the culture and the traditions and customs that went on the harbour, that's another big surprise.
We're running out of time, but when you come to Sydney and you want to go to a souvenir shop and they want to send you some sort of a boomerang with artwork on it, chances are that's Aboriginal, and chances are it tells a story.
Yes.
Do not just buy the boomerang without hearing the story. And the dreams.
Yes, that's right.
Mary Mumbula from the Barangaroo Delivery Authority. Hey, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having us, Peter.
You got it. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from Sydney right after this.
Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from Sydney, Australia, from the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. You know, so many people have a misunderstanding of what a hotel concierge does. And some people are intimidated by them, as a matter of fact. I remember when I was 12 years old and my parents took me to Europe for the first time, and it was the summer, and I remember my mother walking me into the Carlton Hotel in Cannes and holding me firmly by the hand and pointing to the concierge that's saying, don't ask them anything, because she was terrified that it would cost money. And then later she took me in Monaco into the Hotel de Paris. And her wording was even more strict. She basically said, don't touch anything. Joining me now, the chief concierge from the Four Seasons Hotel here in Sydney, George Souza. How are you, sir?
Very good. Very good.
All right.
Thank you.
So should I be afraid of you?
Not at all. Not at all. We are the friendly society. I'm part of the Clé d'Or.
Clé d'Or. So, and you've been a concierge for 30 years.
I've been for 30 years. That's right.
And so you've seen everything.
Almost everything.
Almost everything. I mean... there's such a misnomer about concierges that the only thing you do is get theater tickets or reconfirm airline reservations. That's about 1/30th of what you do.
That is very true. Normally, concierges are addressed as the friend away from home.
Okay, so how many languages do you speak?
Myself, I speak 4.
I'm sorry, that's not good enough. No. 4 languages.
4 languages.
Wow. And so, look, if you're sitting in an international gateway city, as Sydney is, you better speak 4 languages. Right? Probably Mandarin when you're done, right? Because
that's
happening now with 130 million Chinese starting to travel.
Very
you
right.
Better start learning Mandarin very quickly. But what are the kind of requests you get? And I'm not talking about requests from a visiting sheikh or head of state, but something that anybody would request, as unusual as it might be, that you were able to deliver.
Most definitely. I mean, we get all types of questions. We're very strict that everything has to be morally and within the legalities.
Well, of course.
So, we get for as little as people going to the restaurants, of course, which is the usual thing.
Right, restaurant reservations.
Up to proposals that can be stopping the harbour bridge, the bridge climb completely in order for them to have the proposal up there.
Let's hope she said yes.
So far, we have 100%. So far.
But of course, if she said no, there'd be one fewer person on the bridge.
Very right. Very over, right.
You know? You better say yes at that altitude.
That's right.
Then you can always claim later you were affected by the height. You see? There's always an out.
That's true. Very true.
But an unusual request. I mean, for example, I was told of one yesterday where a visiting Arab royalty understood that they were breeding, you know, white, you know, German shepherds and insisted that they find them. And they did. And they flew them back, you know. I mean, what are the crazy stuff you get?
I mean, believe it or not, one of the most challenging one was actually for a proposal on the Harbour Bridge. That was actually the most challenging one that I got. To get a private plane or things, it's very easy for us to do. When you have a certain amount of bridge climbs that's already booked and trying to go around it in order that this particular person only want to be themselves on the Harbour Bridge at the time of the proposal.
And this person didn't know they were about to be proposed to.
They did not know they're about to be proposed
okay,
to.
Okay, so here's my second question. I know this because I've climbed the Harbour Bridge.
That's right.
You're not allowed to take anything with you.
Very right.
So what is it? Where was the ring?
The climber that goes with him.
Yeah.
From the bridge climb.
He had the ring.
She was the one who was carrying the ring.
Oh, okay. So, because otherwise you couldn't take the ring up,
very
right?
Very right. Very right.
And you're cabled in. Have you climbed the bridge?
Many times.
It's great,
loving
isn't it?
And loving it.
By the way, they have different bridge climb times, and my suggestion is go as early in the morning as they'll let you do it, so you're up there as the sun is just coming up.
Sunrise is definitely the best time.
Yeah.
Definitely the best time.
And by the way, where the Four Seasons is located, and I was there when they opened it in 1982 as the Regent, right?
As the Regent, that's very right.
But where you're located, you look out the window from your room at the Four Seasons, you've got the Opera House on the right and the bridge on the left. It's just unreal.
It doesn't get any better than that.
Right. So wait, so they climbed up the bridge.
They climbed up the bridge. They got up to the top. He went on his knees.
How does he get on his knees? He's cabled in.
Oh, that's fine. You still can get on your knees up at the top. And he proposed it then, and everything was videoed and recorded. And she said yes, and it was a very successful story.
And they didn't drop the ring.
They did not drop the ring. The ring was actually stuck into a piece of string.
Oh, they were thinking of everything.
Everything needs to be attached.
Even the ring was cabled.
It was attached, and they only took it off once it was actually on a finger.
Wow. All right, so that was a successful one.
It was a very success story, that one.
But if I want a private seaplane, you're the guy to go to.
Anything and everything. I mean, there's no limitations what the guests they ask, because they come to us for anything and everything while they stay with us.
But you have to say no to some things.
If it's illegal or immoral, at times you have to say no. We're always trying to find solutions. There's always some other things around, but as long as if it's illegal and immoral, yes, we don't do it.
All right, so if it was an immoral proposal...
No, it wasn't.
Or an indecent proposal for $1 million. Remember that movie?
Okay. Yeah, I do. I do remember the movie very well.
I know. But the nice thing about the hotel that you're in now is, and I'm not saying this because I'm staying there, it's true. I walk in today, it is as fresh. You've kept it as fresh and new as it was when it was, you know, you've renovated and restored stuff a number of times. Every hotel goes through a cycle. But the point is, it still works.
It's a beautiful hotel. It's the hotel where I had my first beer with my dad in 1986.
Now we're talking. Now you're making me feel really old. George Sousa, the chief concierge from the Four Seasons in Sydney. Hey, thanks so much, man. We really appreciate it. Hey, thanks to Dara Stone, our chief producer. Jeff Ryder doing the boards for us in Connecticut. Joe Wallace, who's doing the engineering right here. Tara Bojack and the entire staff of the ABC here in Sydney, thank you so much for having us. We'll see you next week, everybody, from another different location somewhere around the world. Bye-bye, everybody.
Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com.